Hello, friends. Welcome back. My guest today is Robert Glaser, and we are talking about how to elevate yourself and reach your potential. Closing the gap between where we are and where we could be is one of the most important pursuits in life. And today, we get to learn Robert's best advice for elevating your spiritual, physical, intellectual, and emotional capacities. Why looking for a cerebral answer to every problem can be a poor strategy. The most powerful changes you can make to impact your growth, and much more. Lots to take away from today, so if any of the strategies or tactics really resonate with you, then feel free to reach out to me at ChrisWillX on all social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, etc. Reach out to me, let me know what you think of this episode or any other episode, you know, just wanting a little bit of company from the outside world during a pandemic. This episode is brought to you by Crafted London. Finding men's jewellery that doesn't suck is very difficult, and Crafted London have nailed it. They are the number one men's jewellery company worldwide. They're sweatproof, waterproof, heatproof, and gymproof. They've got custom designs in gold and silver, necklaces, chains, pendants, bracelets, rings, and earrings. If you've seen me on any of the big cinema episodes on YouTube wearing a necklace, it will always be from Crafted. I absolutely love it. It works with formal wear, casual wear, whether it's daytime or nighttime. All of their pieces are super high quality. The designs are great, and I love them. It's all I wear. Also, they have an unlimited lifetime guarantee, so if your piece breaks for any reason at any point during the entire life of the product, they will give you a new one for free. Get a 15% discount site-wide on everything by going to bit.ly/cdwisdom and using the code MW15 at checkout. That's bit.ly/letter C letter D wisdom and MW15 at checkout. All right, quick maths. The less that your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have, the more money that you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce the costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite, and you are improving efficiency by bringing all your business processes into one platform. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the maths and see how you will profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/modern right now. That's netsuite.com/modern. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. I've worn Whoop for over 4 years now, since way before they were a partner on the show, and it is the only wearable I have ever stuck with because it's the best. It is so innocuous, you do not remember that you've got it on, and yet it tracks absolutely everything 24/7 via something from your wrist. It tracks your heart rate, it tracks your sleep, your recovery, all of your workouts, your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, how much you're breathing throughout the night. It puts all of this into an app and spits out very simple, easy to understand, and fantastically usable data. It's phenomenal. I am a massive, massive fan of Whoop, and that is why it's the only wearable that I've ever stuck with. You can join for free, pay nothing for the brand new Whoop 4.0 strap. Plus, you get your first month for free, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can buy it for free, try it for free, and if you do not like it, after 29 days, they will give you your money back. Head to join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. That's join.whoop.com/modernwisdom. But for now, it's time to elevate our potential with Robert Glaser. What does the word elevate mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, elevate just means taking it to another level. And I think the important part of that, and the way I look at it differently than maybe some others, I think when you talk about success versus achievement, but to me, it's like really like to your potential, not other people's definition, not what other people think you should be doing, but how do you within you, you know, raise your game to another level from the potential that lies within?
And you've looked at a framework to go around that. Obviously, you're a business owner, multinational, international business for multiple years now, into the twilight of running a business, I think, as many people would have said by this time. Not many people have survived
at
least as long as you.
The teenage adolescent years. I sort of fell into this framework by accident. So I had actually started a note to my team about 5 years ago every Friday. It came out of actually a personal leadership event that I went to for a week that was hugely impactful, very focused on improving your morning, things you could do in the morning, kind of think, reflect, read something positive, write. The reading positive stuff that I wrote was just way too rainbow and unicorn-y for me. Like it didn't do it for me. Like, so I had some stories and some quotes and some stuff that I saved. And I just started writing this note to my team every Friday of 40. And it was something about, we were all remote, and it was about getting better or improvement. And it sort of fell into a formula, and I wasn't sure if people were reading it, but I liked writing it. It was a good habit. And eventually I heard back from people that they were reading it. They were sharing it inside the company. I told some other people around it. Eventually I opened it up so people outside the company could join it. And there were a couple hundred thousand people within a few years signed up for it. So what happened was when I went to write a book, our company had really grown. We had sort of tripled during that time period. I was meeting a lot of interesting high achievers from all around the world. And I just, this pattern analysis sort of came up, which was, I tried to write a compilation book called Friday Forward, ironically, which is the book I just released, but no one would buy it. And they said, look, no one knows you and you can't write a compilation. These stories are online. But the agent challenged me to, like, what's the story behind the story? And so when I actually started looking at how had I fundamentally changed my life in the last 3 years, how had we grown as a company? We always said we invested in people holistically. Why were these little notes having an impact on strangers I had never met? And what was common about all these high achievers that I would run into? Like, these four things just, I mean, I had lists and cry, and it just, you know, Punnett squares. And it just always came back to these four principles of, and this notion of the people build capacity faster than others. And it was spiritual, intellectual, physical, and emotional. I just saw that pattern. And actually, from our company standpoint, that's how we had been training our employees. Not, I mean, yes, there's direct training to what they're related to, but we were training them to become better overall, and we were getting the business benefit of that, and they were getting the benefit outside of work.
It's odd to hear someone in the business sphere use the word spiritual. I don't.
Yeah, I struggled with that word. I am not very religious. I tried to find 100 different words that might work for it, because spiritual capacity is not religious in my definition. It is who you are and what you want most. For most people, I think it is being able to identify their personal core values, because I think that ties to their success everywhere. It ties to their success with their selves, with their family, with their business. And like, we work with leaders in our organization to identify their personal core values so that they can understand themselves as a leader. I think most people, that is just the missing, like, rudder in their life in terms of getting the boat going in the right. They might have a really nice boat, might be going really fast and look pretty, but it is like going to Antarctica and they want to be in Hawaii. And it's not until they get to Antarctica that they realize that really doesn't make them happy.
Shit, I didn't mean to be here. I've got two threads open in my mind. First one was Greg McEwen, author of Essentialism. Yeah. On this show, he told us a story about an executive he worked with who'd got to the top of a particular industry, a very well-known industry. 25 years he'd been working there, and found that when he'd made it, he was VC of something international corp. Multi-limited.
I think I know this story, yeah.
Yeah, and he found out that he couldn't talk to his son. Him and his son had a very estranged relationship. His son was 18 or 20 or something, and his son wouldn't speak to him. Literally, the relationship had just devolved into nothingness. And he got to this peak that he thought he was going to, this destination, this Antarctica, and then, in Greg's words, he realized that he'd won the wrong game. And that avoidance of going incredibly fast in precisely the opposite direction. And that is the other part, which is a mental model called direction over speed. That if you're going in precisely the right direction, even very, very slowly, every day you're making progress. Conversely, you can go incredibly fast.
2 degrees and you're going, I mean, this is what we learned with the parallel lines. And there's a slide I show in one of my presentations on capacity building, and it has this beautiful house on a lake. Right, it's a similar thing, and I say to people, you got to be if this house is your goal, you got to be very honest with yourself about the why. Is the house to show yourself in the world you made it, right? Because then that might have one level of satisfaction. But if you say that it's this house that you have to have on the lake for your families and generations, and in getting the house, you lose your kids and get divorced, you are not likely to reach your goals. I just don't think a lot of us, if it was really about family, if family was the why, then you should not sacrifice family in the pursuit of that house. You should actually vacation with a family and pick the land together and work on the drawings together. You should not go isolate from yourself and your family and make money. So I think that's, I came to understand at some point that long-term, the connection between spiritual and intellectual capacity. So intellectual capacity is like your operating system. How do you learn, plan, goal set, execute with discipline in service of what you want? Your long-term goals need to fulfill one or more core values in order for it to work, right? You have to be working towards something that actually fulfills a core purpose, or else I feel like you get to that hollow ending.
Very much so. How do people find their why then? Is that where we start? Is that the beginning of the MOT that we're going through, the service that we're going through?
Yeah, look, a lot of people now, this is a great time to think about it. The why is a whole more complicated process. I consider the why similar to the sort of core purpose. I think it's the topic sentence. I think that's deep and requires a lot of work. If you figure out your core values first, to me, those are the pillars. Like if you can identify, these are the core principles I am, I've always been, I've impacted by. Sometimes the why starts to become clearer because it is literally like the roof or the topic sentence that sits across these pillars of values. I always say for a company, the why is easier because it's always usually why they started, right? Like we started to eradicate blindness and then they figure out the values as they get team. For a person, I think you more want to be clear on the values. And then the why is hard work. And it ties to Friday Forward I wrote this week. I mean, I will say 70% of the time, I think people's why is connected to a deep point of pain or something early from their childhood or an experience they had from which in a positive way becomes the driving force for why they do what they do. I think it's very obvious for some people. I think for other people, it's sitting right there, but it's amazing how they haven't made the, like a couple of times, because I've spent a lot of time paying attention to this, I've asked people a question or pointed it together and, you know, and they look like suddenly very shocked and vulnerable versus some people are aware. I was at one of these dinners a while back and there was one of these, you know, sketch artists who, you know, does the whole thing in real time. And, you know, because I'm around this a lot, I was like, this is an amazing skill. Like, how did you learn this? And she said, my purpose is to help people see and be heard. That was her answer. And I was like, you know, I'm like, you hear that out of 1% of 0.1% of all people. I said, can I ask you a question? And you don't have to answer it. I always predicate you don't want to. Does that come from a very personal place for you? I just love to know. And she looked at me and she's like, I had a significant stutter until I was 15 years old. So to me, that was just like, that's a case study. And I think for that type of person, it's clear for a lot of us, there's this mental firewall in between the experience and that. And, you know, I think some people don't want to be as a victim. To me, it's just your story. It's your truth. You know, the example I think I used in the book is like, let's say you had a single parent who did their best for you and worked three jobs and got you into college and made you successful. But you were alone a lot after school because of that. You might go on to form this award-winning after-school education program. Like it's not, it's just your truth. Your parent, you're not upset about your parent. They did the best, but there was something in that you know you wanted to fix for other people. And in fact, I actually think that severe drive is what's created from that experience.
It's so interesting what our childhood experiences and the predispositions and the presumptions that we have about the world and ourselves and how we connect with others, it carries through and then it keeps on rearing its head. You know, like when you see dolphins jumping out of the ocean, you're like, it's flat. And then every so often it just jumps out and you're like, oh, there's that thing again. Stephen Pressfield was on the show a couple of weeks ago and he talks about shadow careers. Have you heard him talk about this?
No.
Okay, so it sounds like it might tie into what you're talking about there, that a shadow career a lot of the time is analogous to what someone feels their true calling is, but it's far enough away that it protects them from failing at the thing they love.
Super interesting.
So the examples that he gave were people who always wanted to be actors that go and become entertainment lawyers. So they are close to the actor.
I thought you were going to say they become like play coaches or something like that, but yeah.
Maybe, I guess. Maybe the director as well, perhaps, that they get to do it, but they don't. And they get to look after, they do to the, sort the deals. It's analogous. They're kind of there, but it's a shadow career. It's just it's the lesser version of what they genuinely wanted to be. Someone wanted to be a singer on stage and then became a teacher teaching music. And you're like, well, almost there, but without the pressure. And I think that's kind of related.
What's interesting, and I think what we'll see coming out of COVID, I mean, how many people, you know, like people get comfortable, and, you know, in that comfort, they are not willing to leave okay for better, right? So I think, you know, they get laid off and that shadow career becomes the primary career. It's oftentimes it takes that. I think COVID-19 will be a huge career transition for a lot of people. Say, look, you finally took away from me what I wasn't willing to kill, the sort of comfortable. and now I'm going to, you know, in the midst of this without good options, I'm going to lean into that. Right. And it's interesting how that happens.
Do you think that we're going to see the reversal of the polarity of this stuff? Because I was talking to Daniel Sloss, Netflix special comedian, this week, and he said he thinks we've lost a whole generation of creatives and artists in all forms, live musicians that have realized they can't perform live, comedians that haven't been able to keep their comedy going, artists that can't go and sell their work to anyone because no one's going to art exhibitions, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder whether the people who had embraced their proper calling, their full calling, perhaps may have had it muted
go the other way
and go into shadow career, and the people for whom they were looking for this opportunity, I wonder whether you're going to have the entire bar stool get turned upside down.
Yeah, you know, there are always some seismic and permanent changes in these things, but then I think there's always an overestimation of things that will never be the same, which, you know, isn't true. I just think you see a ton of innovation, right? I think I remember watching this video of an exercise person doing it in front of an apartment building, and everyone was out on the roof.
Italy, I think.
Yeah. So, I think everyone will innovate. I think it will be over, you know, at some point. People are actually, you know, really desperate for music and creative, and there'll be a ton of demand. But it's almost like there will be some rotation, right? Some of those people might give up and get into something else and then have a fear of going back. But I think then you have those other people we just talked about who might actually dive into that because there's no risk now. So I continue to see any business requires innovation. I think you'll see new types of art or digital art or outdoor art or concerts, and some of that stuff will stick, and people may, you know, you may just be more outdoor. I'm surprised still someone hasn't figured out how to do a massive socially distanced concert, you know, on a.
We had one. Yeah. I shit you not, 10 minutes behind me.
Yeah.
There was a 1,000-person music festival going on. Yeah. I know we're not talking like Creamfields or Coachella kind of size, but it was individual pens. People came in zones. You had like a fenced bit around you in a group of six in a bubble, and there was service going past, but live band, live music, stage show.
I'm sure I'm sure they were so happy to have that, right?
It was like a big,
charge an arm and a leg for that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so core values in that case, if core values are going to inform purpose, where do we start finding our core values? Be some people listening, perhaps, for whom they are really questioning their current life direction at the moment, and they think, come on, Robert, give me the red pill on core values.
Yeah, it's not that easy to do. I've actually just finishing up a course on it because the thing I get asked about the most. I put a couple resources in Elevate on this and questions you could ask, but it's a process that you go through, and it takes 6 to 12 months, but you start it, and I think you start with some questions, and there's some examples on there on, you know, thinking about the types of scenarios where you've been really I'm going to paraphrase a complicated process into simplicity, sort of how it's done, because I've done this with now a bunch of different leaders and it works. But you ask a bunch of different questions that and you answer them for yourselves that produce responses, like they're kind of best and worst. And you ask them a bunch of different ways, you create a bunch of different lists, and then you start looking across the list for the themes, because where was I successful? Where was I not? What are the characteristics of people I struggle with? Where do I not? You know, one of the, and you start thinking about those questions, you will start to notice patterns that will illuminate your core values. You know, one of the questions that I always say that's the 101, the sort of 303. I don't know if you guys use that numbering in college classes, university classes.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Sorry. Yeah. So 101 is what we call entry-level university courses here. So the advanced version is, if you want to sit down right now, write what someone you would want someone to say at your funeral for your eulogy about you and the impact that you had on their life. I did that exercise long before I did the actual core value work. And a lot of the terminology was in there, because when you get that raw about how do you want to be remembered? What do you want people to think of you? It gets to your values and the impact that you want to make. But you know, I always say the analogy that I give with core values, I think we know our core value when it's crossed, right? And that's a lot of us. So picture you're driving a really nice car through a tunnel, the lights are off, you hit the right side wall, it goes, you know, all this stuff. So you pull the car off the wall and you get in the lane, and then you hit the other wall, right? This is kind of how we make decisions when we don't know what it's like. Once we feel it's crossed, we move away from it. But if that's a nice car, you'd really want the lights to be on and the things to be painted and saying, I shouldn't get near that wall. And that wall is that job, that person, that relationship, because these are opposite values to myself. I talk about the big three. I think when you think about, you know, where you choose to live, who you choose to partner, your vocation or work, if you make those decisions not aligned with your core values, it's very unlikely to work. You can marry someone or partner with someone who's different hobbies, interests, whatever. But when you get to the hard stuff, if your values aren't aligned, I think that's it's not a clone. It's clearly the opposites attract. My wife and I are very different in respects. But when we get to the really hard, difficult stuff, we are philosophically aligned on it. So that's that's the basics. I think you can have decisions in front of you and you should say, I should do that. I should not do that.
I've heard you say that physical fitness, physical well-being is one of your core values. What are the rest of them?
Yeah, so it's I'll just run through them quickly. One of my core values.
Yeah, yours. What are yours?
My core values are health and vitality. So that includes physical fitness. So find a better way and share it, which explains a lot of what I do. Self-reliance. One that I came up with that really is fitting, but it took me a while to get the right word, which is respectful authenticity. And then the last is long-term orientation. So if I pick some activity that is aligned to all of those, or if I pick a parental activity, like I am so happy and I'm doing well. If I do something that crosses a lot of those, then not so well. So when you think about those first two, like find a better way at health and vitality, right? Every year I pick a fitness challenge or something new for me to do because I haven't done it. It's better way. And then it forces me to train and, you know, be healthy, and that's important. And so
was this year's?
This year's is a half marathon, which I'm going to have to do
socially
virtually.
Distanced.
Yes. But I'm working up towards that distance. I've biked from London to Paris 2 years ago with a group. I've done Olympic triathlon. I've just a bunch of different stuff. But it's interesting, like when we talk to our kids around, you know, we have family core values too. And when we talk to them around like not having a third cookie, you know, it is under the value of, because we talk about being healthy and that's not healthy. It's not a rule. It aligns to a value.
Are you familiar with Ben Bergeron from the CrossFit world? You would really, really enjoy his work. So
He's
an ex-coach of Matt Fraser, Fittest Man on the Planet. He has a podcast called Chasing Excellence, which is named after his book. And I would highly, you and him sing very much from the same hymn sheet, especially with regards to the family values thing. Everything that he does is driven from his values. I think that's great. I spent a lot of time this year working on my core values, and it's really informed a lot of my direction. It's helped me to lean into discomfort in projects because I know that it is truly aligned with the things that I do, as opposed to previously, especially if you suffer with imposter syndrome, which we all do.
Which all successful people do. You know, people who've gotten there for the wrong reasons don't seem to have it.
Yeah, we realize
people who are lucky never have imposter syndrome. It's interesting. People who work hard.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment in that case. Yeah, so it's really, really helped. So everyone that's listening, if you haven't gone away and done that, get yourself a copy of Elevate. Otherwise, Chris Sparks, he has Experiment Without Limits. There's some great worksheets in that. Taylor Pearson also has some great worksheets. Some good ways to do it. So we've spoken about the spiritual. Should we go into the intellectual next? Do those two kind of follow on from each other?
Yeah, they actually go in a particular order for me. So let me set the framework, and then we can dive into each one just to make – I'll recast. So spiritual is your core values, kind of, you know, who you are and what you want. Intellectual capacity, as I always say, it's about how you improve your ability to think, learn, plan, execute with discipline. So this is kind of growth mindset, being proactive, long-term goals, short-term goals, routine, habits, accountability. It's kind of once you know what you want, how do you get it? Your operating system. How do you make your operating system better? Then physical capacity, kind of what it sounds, you know, health, well-being, physical performance, resilience, kind of embracing competition. Really, now I know what I want. I know I want to get it. And now I'm motivated to, you know, keep myself in good shape to get there. And then emotional is the last one. It's interesting, the hardest one for a lot of people. This is the world around you. So it's how do you react to challenging situations, your emotional mindset, and the quality of your relationships. So my analogy is that if spiritual capacity was designing the race car, you know, intellectual capacity was building it, physical was sort of testing it on test track, emotional is like, how do you do in that car when it's out on the road with the rain and sun and lots of other cars, right? Some cars will do better than their spec, and some will do a lot worse. So emotional capacity is really interaction with the world around us and the things that we don't control.
Based on your time coaching and also working within your business, which of those four areas do you find people falling short or tripping over the most?
So it's interesting. Like for me, I fall in and out of them, you know, physical, and physical can be a real gateway. If you get tired and cranky, think about it. You lose sight of your goals. You don't interplay well with other people. You know, you kind of give up your learning and your thinking, a lot of that stuff. For most people, I think they haven't even touched the spiritual capacity part. And so the most important thing that they can do is start the work there. That's the one for me that once you get it 90% right, you're pretty good. It doesn't require daily maintenance as much because the other ones align you to it, right? You say, oh, I know my values. So I need, this is what I need to go and learn and do. But I would say that I think that that's the one that people haven't touched. I think a lot of people struggle the most with emotional capacity, particularly right now, in terms of when they know what they want, they're still haven't moved away from people who aren't aligned to that, or they really mix things that they control and that they don't control, right? So perfect example, you and I get into a car accident, you know, this morning. You are enlightened, and so you're like, oh, I've got insurance. That could have been worse. You walk away. You go do three podcast interviews. You have a great day. You meet a bunch of friends. All that stuff. You know, I'm like swearing all day, freaking Chris, and one more thing in the world. And what could go wrong this year? And I get into a fight with my brother. I don't do the goal thing that I said I want to do. Like, we both experienced the same thing, right? How we chose to respond and react to that. We tell ourselves different truth. We tell ourselves the truth that my day got ruined by a car accident. Well, that's not really the whole truth. The truth is you had a car accident and that wasn't your fault, but you control what comes after that.
It's interesting that you haven't mentioned there, or at least I said, what some of the hurdles people overcome. You mentioned that a lot of the time we vacillate between many of them, but intellectual wasn't one of the ones, at least, that came to the forefront of your mind. I think I've got a potential hypothesis about why that might be the case. I think that increasingly solutions to problems in a postmodern, enlightenment, non-religious world are very cerebral. We have this huge proliferation of personal development, self-development, and rightly so. You know, I'm contributing to it now. We put 3, 4, 5 hours of personal development content out every single week.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the time that causes people to look for a very cerebral, very cognitive, very transactional solution. Okay, right. I have a problem with my this thing. Like, which page in Atomic Habits is it that I need to turn to like find the particular habit that I'm doing to do the whatever thing? Or like, you know what I mean? That's how I think that a lot of people are looking to get the solution. Whereas what you've identified there is it's all of the ancillary stuff that actually feeds in to our ability to get that engine to be bigger, to get the fuel efficiency to be faster, to get the steering to be tighter.
Right. And it's an interesting point you make, because I think that a lot of people in that realm are, again, they're looking for that hack or that quick fix. But that's not what it's meant to mean. It meant to mean, once I know what my most important contribution is, I'm going to do everything I can to learn and focus and be disciplined about going in that direction. It is the glue that sort of holds you to that. It's not the quick fix, right? I think there's a misunderstood line between the 80-20 rule and hacks. You know, I think there's always an 80-20 rule. There was just some study I saw yesterday, someone sent me, because they know I love the 80-20 rule, that like 20% of super spreaders, or 19.8% of super spreaders in Singapore, had created 80% of the cases. Like, it was really
interesting. Do you want me to give you another one to add to your collection?
Yeah.
So go for it. The bottom 80% of men on Tinder are competing for the bottom 20% of women, and the top 80% of women on Tinder are competing for the top 20% of men.
Sounds about right.
That's from Datanomics. So there you go. Facts don't care about your feelings, Karen. I'm very sorry about that. Intellectual. How will we talk about expanding our intellectual capacity? What are some of the key areas that you find coming up during your work to do with that?
Yeah, so to a lot of it's goal setting, and I think understanding. I didn't understand this. You know, I would set a lot of 1-year goals and I would meet them and I'd feel great, but they weren't connected. So to me, it's now a reverse engineering process. What are the long-term goals? Do the long-term goals fulfill the values? And therefore, short-term goals are actually down payments on the long-term goals, or else we go for the short stuff versus like, I need to make deposits. When you have two things and one of them is put the envelope in the mail, or the other is climb the mountain, like, we just put the envelope in the mail, and the mountain stays pretty far, rather than take a step. So I'll give you examples at both ends of the spectrum. So really setting what we want, why we want it, and then committing to the pieces to get there. Again, back to that house. Like, I want this house in 10. Well, I need to save the money for it. My family and I need to go to towns, find out where we want it to be. We need to pick a develop. Like, those are all things I could do over time rather than just, you know, deciding get there. And then the other, fully through the whole spectrum on the other side of routine, all that stuff, I think is just accountability, right? Great people and leaders, they want accountability. Other people do not. You know, I was hearing someone reinforce that. Like, Todd Herman, world-class performance coach, and he was saying, like, Michael Jordan, they love accountability. They love being yelled at, told they're not doing something. You know, average people do not want accountability. They want to excuse their way out of it. So there's multiple levels of that. You know, there's self-accountability, which is can be journal writing. It's really annoying to write you're going to do something for 5 days in a row and read it, you know, and then do it. There's peer accountability, where even me sending you what I said I was going to do that week every Friday at 10 a.m., you know, ups it up. And that's where a lot of mastermind groups come in. And then there's public accountability, where people just put their thing out at the beginning of the year. Dear world, this is how much I'm going to weigh at the end of the year. This is what I'm going to do. Anyone who does all three is probably in a unique, rarefied feel.
I like it. Where else in intellectual do people have holes that can quite easily be filled?
I think there is confusion between an intellectual capacity is not doing more, right? It is actually, think about upgrading the processor. When you upgrade the processor, it should crunch more data with less energy, right? So I think a lot of times, like, let's say a lot of people, this crosses into emotional. I struggle with difficult conversations at work. Like, I really struggle with them, performance conversation. So the night before, I sweat, I don't sleep, I get all, whatever. Or I just sit down for a day and I read three books. You know, I listen to Patty McCord's podcast, or Kim Scott, who are like the world leaders on difficult conversations. And I now have upgraded my operating system with the tools and tactics. We're actually doing this now is less work and less energy. That to me is a huge mistake. I am not advocating anyone run the hamster wheel faster. I am saying upgrade the processor so the task requires less work and less energy.
I love that. I think action is the antidote to anxiety comes in quite well there.
Yeah.
Much of the time when we have anxiety about anything which is approaching us in the future, it's because of a fear of a lack of capacity in order to be able to deal with it. Yeah. And then that's where procrastination comes. You think, oh, I'm really going to struggle with that thing, that project, that conversation I'm going to have. And then the deadline arrives. I'll put it off. I'll find an excuse. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll delegate it to someone else, whatever it might be. Whereas, as you've identified there, if you're moving toward that, that goal, right. you're in control.
People have solved these problems. I mean, I interviewed Patty McCord from Netflix, who's, you know, really kind of thought leader on the great culture, but direct with people. And when we talked about like letting people go and something they really struggled with, you know, she would coach her mentees when they had to have one of these conversations. They haven't done it. She's like, call your voicemail, have the conversation with your voicemail 5 times before you do it and listen to it. Right. There was not a secret. It wasn't a hack. It was actually practicing it, doing it, like knowing the framework, how to do it. And it was very pragmatic advice on like, yeah, of course you're not going to be good at this if you never had this conversation. That's why you need to practice having this conversation.
I wonder again, whether this links back to the cerebral, overly cognitive argument that I made a little bit earlier, that we presume because we see wonderful leaders that we guess are just bestowed with this magnetism and they just flow in a room and everyone loves them. It almost makes us forget that it's a skill the same as anything else.
It's a great lie we tell ourselves. A lot of the stories in Friday Forward demystify. If you ever listened to How I Built This Podcast, you know, my favorite part is all these super successful company and people, their worst dark moment where like they were almost out of business and they go on for a long time. You know, for a lot of people, we love to be like, oh, that company was an overnight success, right? Because that ascribes it to timing or luck. Or I don't think professional athletes get enough credit, you know, in cases where you say, oh, he's just so gifted. Like, practices 10 hours a day. Like, if you wanted to be a professional speaker and you practice speaking 10 hours a day, you'd probably be a good speaker. I mean, most of these athletes, look, it's what they love to do, but the amount of work that they put in to practice things before they do them far exceeds anyone in the business world.
100%. I've been hugely on this flex recently that so few people, even if you're fully aligned, your goals, your dreams, what you know you need to do, you've broken it down into the individual steps and you're committing yourself fully, being as present as you can. But think about how far from an athlete's level of preparation everybody else is, except for the total freaks within their industry, the Elon Musks of this world, probably a couple of guys at Google and Facebook, you know?
Yeah.
You think an athlete's optimizing his food, his rest, he's thinking about...
He has three coaches and he's the best in the world.
And
right?
He's surrounded by a team of people who are all on the same journey as him. Yeah. He's sleeping, thinking about what he's going to do tomorrow. He's waking up in the morning at the time that's prescribed, all of that stuff. So thinking like an athlete, no matter what your industry is, I've taken a lot of inspiration from that this year, trying to turn pro.
Right. And who are the athletes that always disappoint, that people are you know, regret signing?
They're the ones who don't do that work, who looked
but they had a lot of talent, right?
The outside coming in, right, the best signing of the year, and then you get him into the training pitch and he's leaving halfway through the day.
When I think about all the busts in National Football League, which is the biggest draft, it was the really talented. They were drooling at a talent, but not passion, and wasn't willing to do the work. Right.
What's next? Physical.
Physical. Yeah.
Physical. How do we expand our physical capacity?
Well, it's interesting, you know, taking physical as an analogy to the other capacities, we understand it more. We tend to think that we have these things or we don't have these things, right? Versus you wouldn't say, oh, I can lift a pound weight 5 times or I can't. You'd say, if I did it for 90 days each day, then it would be easier. So, you know, it's the health, well-being, physical performance. I think we've moved past Greg McKeown talks about this a lot, but I think we've actually fortunately moved past celebrating leaders and executives who get no sleep. And I think actually people
hustle
are now, they're now going the other way, saying I sleep 9 hours a night. We're not celebrating that anymore. I think there's managing stress and this is again, where we build resilience. I think sometimes I think resilience is this emotional and physical flywheel. So I think we do something. And I had a couple conversations with performance experts around this, because I was like, what's the chicken and what's the egg? And the consensus, not by a 80-20, but by a 60-40, was that I think you do something hard that you don't think that you can do. Upon doing that, you gain emotional confidence that lets you be willing to set a next benchmark. But it's actually that effort. I don't think you can will yourself to resilience. You actually have to get through that race, take that extra step, do it. And then you're like, oh, what other lies have I been telling myself? I can't do. And you know, the thing that people are pointing out is that there's a mentor of mine. He's a great speaker. He always offers in a speech $10,000 to anyone who goes back and brings a can of stress into the meeting. He goes, go find me a can of stress and I will pay you. And his point is that stress is not an external thing. It is actually an internal response that we do to ourselves. And you could be stressed about, you know, the deal you're about to close for signing your company for $1 billion. You could be stressed about, you know, not having enough food this day, your job. It actually has the same physical response on your body. We are using a very outdated fight or flight mechanism like all the time, which was meant to save our life. And it does biological stuff to our body that's like pretty unhealthy. So if we sit in that state, we are releasing tons of cortisol. Like if we don't, we are the only ones that can get us out of that state, right? I mean, it is, the world does things that cause stress to us. But as we said before, that is a different threshold point for everyone. It's a different subject matter for everyone, but it shows up physiologically the same.
So you've got, something's occurred, you've had a phone call, something really stressful is about to happen. Yeah. The partnership that you thought was about to go through tomorrow, the merger is on the rocks. What would you prescribe to someone who has had that call to get themselves out of that stress response and to allow them to have that clarity of thought again?
I mean, the basic thing is probably to get outside. You know, you actually have built up that cortisol, which was some, I was talking to someone about this who understands the science of it more. So you've actually built up the fight or flight thing. And so you need to fight or flight, right? So if you
like
actually,
a let off, steam let off.
Yeah. If you got into a big fight, you would probably let it off.
Okay. But punch someone in the street.
Probably go for a run or a interval training or something to actually like, I am very cognizant. I don't like running, but I love how I feel after I run. So I listen to podcasts or I do whatever I can because I know that it just puts me physically in a state that I need to be in. But yeah, you actually need to go blow off that steam, I think, literally or figuratively.
Yes. Breathing as well, I'm going to guess, focusing on deeper breathing, activating the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, look, there's a whole range of things. I think if you do, you know, a meditation, if you do these things and you're comfortable, and you know, these are all things that you could do. It just, I guess it goes to the level of where the person is. It's a good time to turn on your Calm or Headspace app. I actually think some people though, in that immediate thing, aren't able to transition right into that. Like, in fact, I'd say like, let's say this was at 10 AM. You probably want to blow off some steam literally, but you know, what I found on those days is actually the meditation or something else would be really important in the afternoon to make sure that my night's sleep was good later on, right? That I'm not, it's not replaying, but it is hard to move. It takes probably, you know, a Dalai Lama type person to move from severe stress straight to meditation unless they have deep practice in that.
Anyone who's tried to do that, all that you do is sit in the same lovely meditation pose. And then you just ruminate about the thing that you're worried about. And you're like, this is
just...
And then
you get mad at yourself that you can't make
wasting your time.
Yeah. So, I'm not a scientist, biologist, anything, but I do think you need some sort of, you know, walking, breathing, relief valve from that. But look, if you have it out with the person, you might have actually already had that. I think it's more if you go away stewing that, yeah.
I get it. Where else in physical? We've had sleep and stress, two key areas. What else?
I think, you know, exercise, eating. I am not a dietitian. I am not, you know, but I've read, what I try to do is read from everyone that's smarter and take all the intersecting things. And what do I think is the principle? So one thing is that I think there's a lot of science now that there's a lot of brain and body connection, right? Between what we eat and that it crosses the gut level and then affects how we feel or otherwise. I think the also dangerous thing out there is that there's a lot of people saying that whatever their diet is, whether it's gluten or paleo or this, is the thing that everyone should do. And the really smart people who know this will tell you that it's completely the opposite. You know, one man's poison is another man's, now I'm blowing the allergies.
Tonic.
We'll go with the British, the tonic. So I think you know, there are definitely different things that affect each of our health and make us feel bad. And I think you need to figure out what works for you. But in general, you know, less sugar, less processed food, less alcohol, less caffeine. Like, I think those are probably all general principles. Many of us are on a, you know, upper in the morning, downer on a, in the evening plan. And what I understand from, again, the people who understand this, I'm very honest that this is secondhand, is that you're not allowing your body to go through those processes organically if you're always creating them artificially, right? So if you, to the example before, if you only can calm down by having a drink, you've now trained, and you can only get yourself awake by having a coffee, you are now training your body to do that.
It's weakening, very much so. The buttress, the scaffolding that your body's laid upon. You know, like one of those, is it the Dali painting where all of the clocks are melting and they're all really sort of flaccid, all the clocks are melting on the side of a cupboard, and it's like propped up by loads of different individual prongs, like, you know, when you put your hands in pizza dough and it's all falling all over. It's like these are the little prongs. However, if you take them away and you allow yourself to cultivate those capacities naturally, innately, if you choose to have a drink, a coffee, then you get to expand your domain of competence on top of something which is already sufficient, as opposed to
ideally, you'd have the drink after the run and the coffee after the workout, right? Where you've combined in the organic response.
Yeah, I get it. So, emotional, final one.
Yeah, this tricky one. So, there's two big things of emotional. There's a bunch of different things, but the buckets. How you react to the things that you don't control. So that's the first one. And then relationships, both the quality of your relationships and who you choose to spend time with. In the first one, I think it's interesting. Like I have some family members that spend a lot of time on weather apps, and it always frustrates me. I'm like, to me, the weather is the perfect emotional capacity. Like, the weather is going to be the weather, right? You are not going to change it. But if you're constantly, oh, it's going to rain tomorrow, or do you look and it's going to rain tomorrow and like, oh, I'm going to go to the movies and get an umbrella? Or do you actually like get stressed about what the weather is or get frustrated that it's not lining up to what you wanted, right? That is a kind of a microcosm of emotional capacity. You don't control it. How do you react to it? And the second is relationships. I think, you know, we spend a lot of time with people who I would use a term called energy vampires, like where you actually feel worse after spending time with them. Probably not as much time. Like, you and I might see each other once a year, but we have this awesome, uplifting conversation. It's forward moving, whatever. But then I'm spending a lot of that time with a friend that I just don't have the, you know, courage to, that I literally feel worse every time, you know, I spend with them. And I actually think we need to reallocate. You know, Jim Rohn said, you are the average of the people you spend, the five people you spend the most time with. I think we need to even make a list of who do we need and want to spend more time with, and how, without breaking up or blowing up with those people, do we remove energy from those relationships? And an example someone gave me is like, don't say stuff you don't mean. Like, we should have lunch again next week. Like, after you just got, like, you just got through lunch and you're terrible and this person complained about the thing over. Like, we should do that again soon. You don't have to say that. you don't have to call someone and have the same conversation, you know, with that relative every 4 days. You could call them every 6 days. So this thing about energy vampires, really, like, people you feel worse with after spending time with, you need to figure out a way to spend less time with those people. They are not moving you towards your spiritual and intellectual capacity in any way.
The British equivalent of an energy vampire is a mood hoover.
Yeah. But you guys are so passive aggressive.
It's so funny.
You'll have a hard time. You'll be like, no, let's definitely get lunch next week. And, like, and then afterwards, like, oh my God, that person is the worst. Like, you know.
Yeah, I think there's certain things that both Americans and British could take from each other. Yeah. And you are correct. The passive aggressiveness, the quiet behind the back, sulking, very sulky nation.
I was
at
a conference with someone in our industry with a bunch of competitors, and they walked up and hugged all of them and you know, walked away. I was like, that is so nice. We wouldn't do that in the US. You guys all get along. Like, we all hate each other. I thought it was so stereotypical.
Okay, so we've looked at the relationship side of emotional. What's left?
I think it's the things that we control. So circumstances, and then people, and I think there's also a piece that, again, to resilience, there is that emotional side of resilience. Like, how do I plan for the next thing I'm going to do that I didn't think that I could physically do? Because what I think keeps people moving forward in that is being vulnerable, is getting out of their comfort zone. You know, I think that greatly increases their emotional capacity. People want to share. People want to be vulnerable. They're just scared to. And when they do, the depth of their relationship, you know, two people have been having this superficial conversation for 5 years, aren't talking about the real thing that they want to talk about that would actually create the bond that they're seeking.
Massively. A huge problem amongst young guys, I think, especially ones that are professionals, type A's, trying to be overachievers. They, and I did for a very long time, I presumed that strength and confidence and bravado and courage and all of these things went along with not showing vulnerability. Whereas quite the opposite is true, that the people with whom I have the deepest relationships are the ones that I've been the most vulnerable with. And it becomes self-fulfilling. When you tell someone something which in the wrong hands could be quite catastrophic to you, that's really where you make a connection. And I think there's a book that's up on the big shelf up there, The Lonely Century by Norina Hertz, talking about this loneliness epidemic that we've got at the moment. And I wonder how many people are combating loneliness by trying to be overly confident, by thinking I am going to be the sort of friend that other people would want to be friends with. And the truth is that being more vulnerable and showing that side of you that is precisely the opposite of what you think other people want might be the quickest way to make a connection.
I think there's a lot of culture in this. There's a lot of gender history in this, particularly with boys, you know, feelings. I've heard the story, you know, closer to home for you. I can't tell you how many times I've heard a story from a coach or a speaker, an Irish boy, you know, and his father who just wanted to have a real discussion and give him a hug. And I mean, my friend Philip McKernan, you know, just talks about, you know, it wasn't until he was 45 that he and his dad said they loved it to each other. They were, you know, just, it was this thing you didn't do and they danced around it. And it was like, as a son, it's all he wanted, you know, what, and I feel like I've heard, so there are cultural implications in a lot of this stuff, but I do think generationally it's changing a bit, which is nice.
I really like the analogy that you drew between using the weather app. So we've had a lot of Stoics on recently, including Ryan Holiday, and the weather's a good example. Using the weather as, look, controllables versus uncontrollables, the dichotomy of control, all this sort of stuff. But thinking about the fact that I was laughing at how your friends who like to look at the weather app, because I'm like, oh, ridiculous. Why would you do that? But really, everything on your phone is the weather app, apart from individual messages.
The weather app? Yeah.
Precisely. You're watching the presidential debate. Do you think that what you say is going to change what Donald Trump or Joe Biden says next time?
But it affects you. And hopefully my mom won't listen to this, but my mom was in a tizzy the other night. And I was talking to her and, you know, upset, more normal about what's going on. I was like, and she just had surgery. So she has to sit there. I'm like, how long have you watched the news today? It was the first thing I said. I was like, I'm like, turn it off. Just turn it off.
You've overdosed on news today, Mom.
I can tell the two things I've been able to tell in COVID when people are in bad places are, and usually it's probably both. One, they've been consuming too much news, you know, and two, they have not gotten enough sleep. Those seem to be very clear markers of sort of just low ability to deal.
That's a one-way ticket to feeling pretty miserable in 2020, I think. News, too much news, not enough sleep.
And that's why I believe in these buffers. Like, I leave my phone downstairs. I don't really – this guy texting me, you know, this morning asking me something about podcasts this afternoon. Did you get – I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't look at my phone for the first hour in the day, and I leave it downstairs because nothing good happened overnight, you know, other than some guy emailing me that there's some guy, you know – 11 million pound state and I'm the, you know, beneficiary, you know, what I can do, I just send them a check. Like, nothing great happens overnight. And I'm not a doctor, so it's not an emergency. But as soon as I look at that, I'm going to be pulled into that world.
100%. I mentioned before we started, I'm a club promoter and I have a little quip that I always use.
Really, nothing good happens overnight.
Dude, after 1 a.m., nothing interesting has ever happened. Ever happened.
Probably be a bad email, yeah.
Precisely. Self-limiting beliefs was something that I wanted to talk about with you. A lot of people, we mentioned imposter syndrome earlier on. How can people overcome those self-limiting beliefs?
I think you need to look at the source of them. I think a lot of times, I think you can think back to childhood. There were a lot of things placed on people and think about where that came from. Also, there's stories that we tell ourselves because we don't want to do something and we don't want to fail at it. Like, I always think it's interesting when someone says, you know, there's a framework that a coach I worked with once used, more business coach, but so it says, I can't do that. I could never write a book. Okay, well, why? Give me the five whys why you can't write a book. So his thing is he takes the five reasons why you can't do it and then asks you how you could solve each of those five things. Well, I don't have the time. Well, how could you solve that? Well, I could, you know, I spend 30 minutes every morning writing it. Well, I don't have the experience. Well, how could you solve that? Well, I could hire one of these companies that does, you know, ghostwriting. Well, I don't have a topic. How could you solve that? Well, I could spend a few of those days in 30 minutes, like picking topics and ask my friend. And so like it basically like rhetorically puts it back on themselves because I sometimes, again, we were told we couldn't do something and the most damaging ones come from third parties. But a lot of time, I think it is a protection mechanism. Look, there's some reality. Like I could not be a professional football player. Like I don't have the talent. I could work as hard as I want, but I don't have the talent. But I just I always squirm when someone tells me they can't do something that I intuitively know that they can do because I think they're just trying to protect themselves. Because the alternative of saying I don't want to do that doesn't sound as good.
I agree about internalizing the bad third party rhetoric.
Yeah.
Every bad inner voice that we have was once a bad outer voice, I think.
Yeah. Someone told you were stupid your whole life. Like that's a very hard thing to overcome and believe you're smart, right? Or someone said that to you, or those things are pretty damaging.
It can also, going back to what we said at the very beginning, talking about the spiritual, a lot of the time people I think can internalize that and use that as the main thrust of their career. So there's another Greg McKeown example about a guy that was a CFO, I think, or a COO or something, but still believed that he was terrible at maths.
Yeah.
Because his like some grade school, primary school teacher yeah. had said, you suck at maths at 8 years old. And he'd carried that with him and then made it his career and still COO or CFO of this huge company still believed that he couldn't do maths.
And look, I'm very believing, remember my respectful authenticity value. I believe in telling people the truth, but I think as a manager or leader, you can do decades of damage, right? So if you worked here and I was like, Chris, you're just not, take some right out of the office. You're just not management material, right? It's like that could sit with you for a long time. You could be really like have some, you know, confidence issues from that. But if I sat down and said, Chris, you know, I've looked at you, what you've been managing, you seem to love being an individual contributor. You know, you want to sell your own thing. You want to be responsible. Like that's very different than leading a team. I think you could actually do really well in this, but this requires leading a team. And I don't really think that's actually what you want to do or whatever. Like those are very different ways where one might actually help you realize that, oh, people, I just thought I had to lead a team to get ahead. That's actually not what I like. And I've been doing it versus me crushing your soul by attacking you, you know, personally. And I've heard from a lot of people that how a comment from my boss has had 5 or 10 years of damage, you know, on their confidence in their career.
It's dangerous, man. As you rise up through the ranks of any business and you start to get subordinates below you, or if you're a business owner and you have the entire company below you, the words that you say have a disproportionate impact on people long after you've left them or they've left you. I do think there's a big lot of responsibility in that.
Yeah,
I don't often hear talked about actually either in the business.
No, and the truth is the truth, right? So that, to say, Chris, you are not doing well as a manager, that is the truth, right? But then the other truth is, and I think it's because you actually don't want to be one if you thought about it. And you want to be, you don't want to manage salespeople. You want your $2 million book of business. You want the credit. That's great. But you actually just need a role that reinforces that, right? There are two different ways to have that conversation.
I love it. Final thing, you talk a lot about how we can use and relate to our competition. I think in 21st century,
yeah.
always on social media, comparisons, how much do you earn,
yeah.
the new house, the new car, how can we use and relate to our competition?
Yeah, to me, like healthy competition is I actually think we need to learn to win well and lose well. And look, all monopolies happen because there's no competition. So I actually believe that competition is just about raising our own standards and understanding that whatever I'm doing today, if I'm doing the same thing in 10 years, it's probably not a winning strategy, right? I like to say, if you are the best horse and buggy repair person in the entire world, you probably don't have a lot of work right now. So to me, it's raising the bar on yourself, embracing it. I'm pro competition in that way. I'm not all saying it's all about winning. I don't believe in that at all. But I think when you elevate the playing field, you do it for everyone. Like, I don't want to be the 10,000th best place to work. Like, I want to be the, you know, top 10 best places to work. I don't think you'd have a lot of people who'd say, like, oh, I want, you know, the person I want to fill this role is the person that no one wanted, right? You know, there's usually someone that everyone's trying to do. So my favorite example is the most enlightened yoga teacher in the world will compete for a single job at the biggest, you know, most prestigious yoga studio. Like, it just is reality. And there's times when we need to win well, and there's times that we need to lose well, but at least we're trying to up our game.
I like it. Robert, man, I really enjoyed today. Where can people go if they want to sign up to your newsletter? Where else do you want to send them?
Yeah, so everything's really integrated now at robertglazer.com, glazer.com. The books are there, Elevate Podcast is there, and they can sign up for the Friday Forward newsletter as well.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much for today.
All right. Have a good one.